and welcome to episode 133 of season 11 of Movie Room Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is John from the Armchair Commander Podcast. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks for having me again.
Yes, I'm looking forward to our deep conversations once again about Band of Brothers and everything that's going on. So episode 133 begins with Lipton being very happy to oblige and ends with Winters beginning to narrate the epilogue. So we ended things yesterday with Winters informing Lip that he got an order from above that Lip can no longer serve within Easy Company. Because the men won't respect him, and we get a nice little jab from Winters, basically talking about the fact that Lip was the most respected of the junior officers, so it really wasn't something that he doesn't see it as a problematic issue, but those are the regulations, and that's what you got to do. And he basically asked Lip if instead he wants to. If he's able to move him up and give him a position in the battalion. And Lip's response begins this segment where he says, "I can think of a few better, sir." Which it's an interesting answer because he's basically saying it's a great choice. This is what I want. And Winters goes, good. He goes, "Well, right now at the airfield, there's a German general who's a little PO'd about having to surrender to Private Babe Heffron from South Philly. He thinks it's beneath his stature." "Understandable, sir." "Yeah. I thought Second Lieutenant Carwood Lipton from West Virginia could soothe his ruffled feathers." "No problem, sir." And then he goes, "Major, is this the type of job I can expect from now on?" He goes, "Yep. When we're not sunning ourselves by the lake." And he goes, "Lieutenant." So it's a nice way for them to do this, for Winters right away. I think it goes along with what you were talking about yesterday about the fact that the men in Winter Circle were given cozy positions. He tried helping as many as possible, and helping Lipton by giving him this type of position definitely works. And I'm always impressed with the fact that the continuity of constantly having Lipton's scar on his face, that we can keep seeing it. It's not like the Harrison Ford scar on his chin that various movies and franchises have given a new myth as to what really happened and things like that. Like with Indiana Jones, how as a kid he is using the whip and that. That cuts him and stuff like that. But here, you have this miniseries where through the first three episodes, Donnie Wahlberg doesn't have this, and then everything after that, you have to constantly show him and other men also with scars that they've incurred, throughout the series. So I like the continuity of that. I think it's done really well.
Yeah, it shows great work on the part of their makeup artists too.
Yeah, for sure. And then the next scene, we see the Jeep pulling up, and there's a whole bunch of German soldiers standing in formation, and Lip jumps out of the back of the Jeep and is saluted by Liebgott, and then a German general strides over to Lipton, and he doesn't even look at Lipton. He looks at Winters, and he basically nods to Winters. And Winters just nods back. And it's a nice gesture the way that they show this. Because Winters is basically saying, "No, I'm not the guy, he's the guy." And then he outstretches his hand, saying, "You can surrender to Second Lieutenant Carwood Lipton." And the German, you can see the disdain on his face, but he still pivots and looks at Lipton, and he says, "With your permission, I would like to address my men briefly." Lipton then says, "That will be fine, General." So It's nice to see the way that they do this, and then the German acknowledges Lipton, and then he acknowledges also Winters at the same time. It's funny that he says that this general doesn't want to surrender to a private, but he also doesn't want to surrender to a lieutenant, but he still gives some respect to a major, even though he might be looking for somebody who's even closer to his rank in this type of situation. And then they give us something very interesting here. I have trouble believing that this really happened at this particular juncture in real life, because it feels far too convenient for this to happen. So a truck that is sitting there blocking Winters' viewpoint, it moves away, and we get to see that Sobel happens to be there, which again, it makes I think I recall reading that this happened like maybe a few months earlier or something like that. It didn't happen at this point, but the idea of putting it here helps give us a little bit more closure to the whole story of everything that was going on. So it's an interesting way to do this. The way that things have changed since the first part of this entire series, which is great, because Sobel started off as the commander of everyone, where he wanted the respect of everybody, and here he's not willing to give that same respect back that he needs to. So Sobel and another soldier are walking by, and the soldier then salutes Winters as he walks, and Winters salutes back, and Sobel just looks away. And Winters then calls out, and he goes, "Captain Sobel." And he looks at him and goes, "Major Winters." And he goes, "Captain Sobel, we salute the rank, not the man." And Sobel then looks really pissed off, but still faces him and gives him the salute that Winters deserves. And I think it's great closure for this little scene, of the whole series, for them to do it this way. And I mean, Liebgott gets a little smirk from that whole thing right there, because everyone knows the disdain that Sobel had for Winters, because Sobel wanted to be the I guess the savior of all the men, and the fact that Winters usurped him quite easily, is definitely a point of contention that he held for many, many years, if not decades afterward.
No, it's definitely a great scene, especially with the power dynamic shift. Very kind of full circle moment.
That's right. And then Winters looks at Nixon, who just smirks and shakes his head as if to say, "I can't believe you just did that. You should have just let it go, and that would have been it." And then we're gonna get this for a few minutes right now, where we're gonna get the speech of this German general that wants to tell his men. And obviously, since he's saying it in German, we don't know what he's saying, and neither does Winters or Nixon. So they ask Liebgott to translate for them. So basically, what this German general says is, "Men, it's been a long war. Been a tough war. You fought bravely, proudly for your country. You are a special group. You found in one another a bond that exists only in combat among brothers who've shared foxholes, held each other in dire moments, who've seen death and suffered together. I am proud to have served with each and every one of you. You deserve long and happy lives in peace." So again, I like the speech, but I do take a little task for the fact that they decide to give us something so powerful about the story of Easy, and have it as a general of the enemy explaining this whole thing to them. That's the thing that sort of, I mean, they're trying to equate what the men in Easy did to what the Germans did, and I don't think that that's a fair way to compare them.
Yeah, it does give a little bit of that, like the myth of like the clean Wehrmacht. I think it does feel odd to hear from that point, but I think it makes for good storytelling from the standpoint of we have followed these men start to finish a war, and now, somebody that is their sworn enemy is putting into, I think what makes it powerful and, makes it a great scene is that even though we don't necessarily agree with the fact that, like, yeah, these guys are Nazis and all that, like, why are we comparing ourselves to them? The fact that they have somebody finally vocalizing their own experience, I think, is what truly makes it powerful. Like, not to mention, you can also make the argument that, like, from their standpoint, you can also be like, like you said, like, I don't agree with this. You could also impose that on the guys of Easy Company, where they're like, screw you. Like, all the things you said apply to us, not you. Like,
Right. Exactly. I mean that's one of the things. It's again, it's very, very interesting the way that they do that. It might be that they could say, okay, screw you, but the from a storytelling part perspective, by having the enemy say this important information about the bond that men feel, I don't know, in some ways I feel as if it's cheating us. That in some way we should have heard this from Winters or from Sink or something like that. I mean, again, there's nothing we can change. This was made 25 years ago. This was the decision that they made. I can agree or disagree with it. It doesn't make a difference. It won't change the fact that this is what it was. And again, I think it's effective storytelling. I just feel that something is off because it's coming from the opposite, it's coming from the enemy.
right.
And that but again, I can't question what they decided to do here, because
It also
they're the
it
experts, not
does
me.
it doesn't sit right either, because if you think about the episode immediately preceding this one, they just liberated a concentration camp. So it's like, I don't know, in a way it does feel like almost a little redemptive, but to the Germans, and it's like, we don't need this, really.
But again, that's what we have. Again, and for everyone listening, don't get me wrong. I love that they've put this into words. My problem is who's saying the words. Not that it's here, because it's
Well, I
important,
mean,
and it helps tell us, what it helps to I guess condense and give us succinctly a few sentences as to what these men have gone through and what we've seen them go through over the last 10 hours also.
to be fair, the German general is just stealing from the St. Crispin Day speech from Henry V, but still.
Well, that's what Ambrose did too. So,
Yeah.
but yeah, I understand that. At this point, we start getting some emotional parts of this whole story, which I think is great, because and the music by Michael Kamen here is just superb. It really adds to everything by the way that we can see everything that's going on here, and what these men have all gone through. And then the shot changes, and we're actually back to where we were at the very beginning of part 10. Because we get to see Winters in the lake swimming, which is something that they left us with just about 2 weeks ago when we were paying attention, when we were watching it. And Winters says, "Towel, towel, towel, towel." I don't know why he needs to say it 5 times, but I guess he needed it. And then Nixon, who's on the side there, decides, he's continuing to look through the pictures that Winters gave him at the beginning. That he had to bribe someone to get all these pictures from. And Nixon shows him a picture of the two of them and goes, "Take a look at these two kids." And again, it's a great shot that they knew to take that picture when they were filming, the Curry scenes, that they could use it later on. And Nixon goes, "What the hell happened to them?" And Winters looks at him and goes, "New Jersey, huh?" And he goes, "Yeah. Think about it." He goes, "Yeah, I am. Are you awake yet?" And then Nix looks at him and goes, "Awake? Time to go to bed." And then Nixon does something that you never would expect the character of Nixon to do. He then dives into the water in his own clothes. And I think that the interpretation here is that Nixon is also turning over a new leaf, turning the page in his life by cleansing himself by jumping into the water type of thing. So I like it. I also find it really funny that, Winters is so shocked about having to go to New Jersey. I mean, he lived in Pennsylvania less than an hour from New Jersey. It's not as if he's telling him he's got to go to California. It's something that's going to be very close to where he was living.
Yeah, but also the prospect of New Jersey doesn't sound fun, so.
Okay, well, I was born in New Jersey, so
Oh,
for
I'm
me,
sorry.
no, that's okay. It wasn't my choice. No, so I don't take offense. I know that people say a lot about New Jersey that way, and that's fine. And I've said this story before, but 4 years ago when I was visiting the States, and I was actually staying at a friend in New Jersey, and I drove through Pennsylvania, and I actually drove very close to where Winters was living, and I only found that out afterwards. I didn't know at the time, so that was just really interesting. So it's not that far from that perspective, but then the scene changes again, and now we're watching a baseball game, which is great. I love the way they do this final scene here. Buck is there, and he goes, "Come on," and he tags someone out. And they have a little bit of a Doc Rowe. He tags Doc Rowe out, and then there's a little bit of discussion. He goes, "You're out." And he goes, "Come on, Jimmy." He goes, "All right, we got one down. Come on, Pee Wee, let's get Webster." We see that Webster's up to bat, and he goes, "Come on, Pee Wee, let's get him." Now, I like the way that they do this, and we'll talk about this for the rest of today, and we'll talk about it tomorrow also. But I always felt a little shortchanged by this epilogue here, because there are a lot of the characters that didn't make it into part 10, but that were still alive that we don't get any of their history of. Like they don't even tell us what happened to Garnier. He was injured, I understand, but it would have been nice to, I mean, the choice to have them all play baseball this way and start focusing on the various characters is great. There's no question about that. And sometimes it makes you think that it's possible that this was somewhat of a dream sequence, the way that they're doing this. Because somehow they got Buck to come back. I mean, I don't know if that really happened or not. Because I mean, the book obviously doesn't talk about that. It doesn't say Buck came back to play baseball so that we can talk about what everyone did, that type of thing. So it's an interesting way to do it. I mean, the book deals with the histories and futures of everyone in a different way. But I mean, I like the way they do it. But it's very succinct. Each guy gets like a paragraph or just a few lines explaining what they did and stuff like that. But there's no place where it says that Buck Compton came back, which also doesn't make sense to me that, 2 months later he's going to come and visit them in the middle of Austria. Everyone wants to go home at that point. So again, there's no way of finding out if Buck was really there or not. But again, it makes for a good epilogue for the series by saying that Buck came back. So at this point, Winters begins the narration and goes, "Buck Compton came back to see the company to let us know he was all right. He became a prosecutor in Los Angeles. He convicted Sirhan Sirhan in the murder of Robert Kennedy and was later appointed to the California Court of Appeals. So again, it's a nice way of them giving us a short, succinct history slash future of the real Buck Compton. I mean, what they say in the book, and obviously I'm not going to be able to I'm not going to talk about everybody because a lot of the characters in the book are not in the movie itself or don't really have much to do. But the ones that jump out, I will. So Buck Compton, it's on page 252. It says Lieutenant Buck Compton stayed in public service jobs, so he became more famous than rich. He was a detective in the LAPD from 1947 to 1951, then spent 20 years as a prosecutor for the district attorney's office, eventually becoming chief deputy district attorney. In 1968, he directed the investigation of Saran Saran, then conducted the prosecution. In 1970, Governor Ronald Reagan appointed him to the California Court of Appeals as an associate justice. He and his wife Donna have two daughters, one granddaughter. His reputation is that he remains the best athlete in the company. He is said to play a mean game of golf. Again, the book was written in 92. A lot happened to him after that, but I'm only going to go with what they talk about here. It's very interesting that they don't mention the fact that he was a police officer at any point. And they, I guess, shied away from talking about people's family. I guess they wanted to purposely keep their private lives private enough, which makes sense. Then we get a shot of Webster, and it says David Webster became a writer for the Saturday Evening Post and Wall Street Journal, and later wrote a book about sharks. In 1961, he went out on the ocean alone and was never seen again. So again, they're quickly telling us what eventually happened. The book on page 250 talks about it. So it says David Webster could not understand how anyone could stay in the army. He wanted to be a writer. He moved to California and paid his bills with a variety of odd jobs, as he wrote and submitted articles in a book on his wartime experiences. He placed many of the articles, the top being in the Saturday Evening Post, but he could not find a publisher for his book. He became a reporter, first with the LA Daily News, then with the Wall Street Journal. In 1951, he married Barbara Stossel, an artist and sister of Walter J. Stossel Jr., who became U.S. ambassador to Poland, Soviet Union, and West Germany. Webster had always been fascinated by sharks. The shark, for him, became a symbol of everything that is mysterious and fierce about the sea. He began gathering material for a book of his own. His research went on for years. He studied sharks firsthand, underwater, swimming among them, and caught many fishing with a hand line from his 11-foot sailing dinghy, which he named Tusitala, which means teller of tales. He wrote the book and submitted it 29 times, but could not convince a publisher that anyone wanted to read about sharks. On September 9th, 1961, Webster set sail from Santa Monica with squid bait, a heavy line, and hook for shark fishing. He never came back. A search the next day discovered that Tusitala awash 5 miles offshore. One oar and the tiller were missing. His body was never found. Barbara was able to get his book on sharks published in 1963. The book gives a little more information. I like the succinct way they do it in the show. It's always nice to hear a little
Yeah,
more information.
it's a lot better than it's a lot better than he was really into sharks and then probably
That's
got hit by
right.
one.
Exactly. So shout out Jake Cluett, friend of the show who loves sharks, who probably should read Webster's book if he's never done so. It might be interesting. I don't know.
He was just a guy born in the wrong time. Like just a little bit later in life, he could have hopped on the Shark Week trend
That's
with
right.
Discovery Channel.
That's very
Like
true. And again, we continue to see the men playing baseball, and someone screams, "Go, go, 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 go." And then we get a shot of Martin, and we hear Johnny Martin would return to his job at the railroad. And then that's where he gets cut off. But again, I like the way that they're doing this. And we'll talk about Martin tomorrow with that whole thing. But I like how they do it. Just to tell us that each of these men, they didn't go to do huge things to change the world after this, but they still did something with their lives. And each of them in their own way made their life remarkable. And made the lives of everyone around them remarkable. It doesn't you don't have to have the characters. This guy went on to be the CEO of this, and this one went on to run for president, and this one, no, you don't need that. Because the idea of the men of the greatest generation was that most of them didn't do big things. The idea was is that they went and were they did heroic things to help save their country, and then they went back to their their normal lives with no need to feel, that they need to do something larger, because doing what they did was great enough, that type of thing. I like that. Do you have anything else you want to say about this 5-minute segment?
I think it's a good way to close out the series, and obviously we have another like 3 or 4 minutes to do afterwards. But it also is like very cliche. It's much like, the childhood film Sandlot. So it's hard not to think about the Sandlot when you're watching this particular scene, which I think takes away from it a little bit, but also, obviously we need to find a way to close out and kind of give some closure for the people that remain, and I don't think there's much better. But no, it is really kind of a shame about Webster, especially because, he was able to get his shark book published after his death. And then, something we talked about yesterday was, obviously the success of Ben, Easy Company in pop culture and all that starts with the book Band of Brothers by, Ambrose. And then once the series became popular, like I mentioned yesterday, multiple members of Easy Company got their own books. And Webster's self-written book did become super popular once the series came out. So it's truly a shame that he didn't, get to see his work
Right.
become popular.
Completely agree with you on that. But unfortunately, we can't change what happened in history.
Right.
Right. So today's segment will be World War II movie trivia, where we'll have 5 random questions about World War II movies. Random trivia questions. Let's spin the wheel and see what type of questions John's gonna get. Round and round and round the wheel again. Are you familiar with the movie The Dirty Dozen?
Yes.
Okay. So in the movie The Dirty Dozen from 1967, what task are the men of the Dirty Dozen given in order to prove their worth to Colonel Breed and the other commanders who are skeptical about the entire plan?
God, I haven't seen that movie in 10 years. I don't remember what their test was.
I will give you a hint. The colors of blue and red are very important in that task.
Is it stealing a French flag? I don't know.
No. They had to play in a war game and take over the opposing the opposing side's
Okay.
headquarters.
Yeah, it's been a solid minute since I've seen that film, so.
Okay, well I guess it's time for
Yeah,
you to see that again.
we'll have to bump it up on our priority of watching list.
Okay, makes sense. All right, so let's spin the wheel again for your next question. In the 1998 movie Saving Private Ryan, what is the phrase the men keep using that Upham doesn't understand?
Oh, FUBAR.
FUBAR, exactly. Very good. Maybe I should have just said what's the acronym that they use as opposed to what the phrase, but you
Took me
got
a
it. That's good.
second, but
That's great. That's okay. That's okay. Perfect. All right, let's spin the wheel for your next one. Okay, have you ever seen the movie called The Train, which I believe is from
I have not seen
1953?
that film.
Okay. The question is, what is being smuggled on the train in the movie The Train?
Gold.
The Germans are smuggling something, exactly. Okay, gold is a good guess, but what else were the Germans very fond of smuggling and stealing?
Artwork.
Goes back to our questions about looting. Artwork, very good. French art treasures. Okay, let's go to your next question. Spin the wheel again. Okay, have you seen the movie Guns of Magdalene?
A very long time ago, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okay, in the movie The Guns of Navarone from 1961, where is Navarone? You know, geographically, where is Navarone?
Italy?
Go a little east.
Greece?
Yes, it is a Greek
Okay.
island. Right, now we'll spin the wheel for your final question, which sounds to me that you're going to be very happy that we're done.
I'm not doing well on this one.
Name one of the two main stars of the 2007 film Atonement.
Keira Knightley?
Very good. And do you know the other one?
No.
Okay, no, that's oh,
Yeah.
you got one. So that's important. It's James McAvoy,
Okay.
who is also in Band of Brothers. So, yeah, that works very well. Okay, so you have your homework set
Yeah.
up for you. That's all right. All right. So now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Round and around and around the wheel goes. And let's see where it's going to stop. Okay, this is a movie from 2014, starring Keira Knightley and Benedict Cumberbatch, about the efforts to try and break the Enigma Code.
The Imitation Game.
Very good. Excellent. Nicely done, John. Nicely done. All right. So, John, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, you can if you're interested in another podcast about movies or pop culture, you can find the Armchair Commanders podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Audible, all pretty much anywhere that you get podcasts. We frequently have guests on ourselves that range all the way from actors who have been in films to historians that have written books and museum directors, everything in between. So you can find us there. If you want to find us on social media, we have Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, all under Armchair Commanders Podcast.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So, John, you feel like you want to come back tomorrow to continue talking about the epilogue of Band of Brothers?
Absolutely.
All right. So, until tomorrow, curry!
All right.